Good afternoon. Welcome to Johnson Chapel, to Amherst College, graduates, families, friends. Today we welcome Mohammed El-Baradei, Director General of the International Atomic Energy Agency. In accepting the 2005 Nobel Peace Prize, which he shared with the agency, he noted that peace is not a single achievement, but it is an environment, a process, and a permanent commitment. Certainly, El-Baradei's outstanding career is a testament to his own lasting commitment to ensuring a more peaceful world. In 1964, 2 years after graduating from Cairo University, El-Baradei joined the permanent missions of Egypt to the United Nations, eventually rising to the rank of senior fellow in charge of the United Nations International Law Program at its Institute for Training and Research. He earned his doctorate in international law from New York University in 1974 and arrived at the agency as a legal advisor in 1984. 24 years later, he is serving his third term as its Director General. Under his leadership, the agency has undertaken nuclear investigations in Iraq, Iran, North Korea, and Pakistan, as well as efforts to help developing nations harness nuclear power, not for destructive, but for constructive purposes, not for war, but for medical care and resource management. His worldwide accolades include not just the Nobel, but also the Roosevelt Institute's Four Freedoms Award, the Golden Dove of Peace Prize from the President of Italy, and the Greatest Nile Collar, the highest civilian decoration in his native Egypt. To that list, this weekend we add an honorary Doctorate of Laws from Amherst College, a humble token of our recognition of the vital work of Mohammed El-Baradei, who perhaps more than any other individual stands between the precipice of nuclear disaster and the survival of the human species. Mohammed El-Baradei.
Well, President Marx, let me thank you for your very kind introduction. Let me also say it's an absolute delight for me to be here at Amherst this afternoon. It's a breath of fresh air for me to come back to college, to interact with young people, to see hope, to see the future. I'm very intimidated to speak at the chapel because I'm not a preacher, you know, and I can't think of myself as one. What I basically speak about is common sense, you know, and I'm always baffled, you know, why after 2 millennia we're still unable, you know, to follow common sense, to follow the basic values which we all share, irrespective of wherever we're coming from, whether we're Buddhist, Hindus, Muslim, Jews, Christians. I mean, we all have same basic core values: tolerance, decency, respect for each other, social solidarity, fairness, equity. These are the values which for 2 millennia we have been trying to follow, with some success, with a lot of failures, lots of setbacks. And yet, we cannot give up. We have to continue to endure. And for the young people, particularly for those who are graduating today, you are the future. We definitely have to make a difference. You will make a difference. Coming here last night from Vienna, I read the speech by President Marx last year. You know, And I thought, my God, I don't really have to add anything, you know. He basically reflected exactly what I thought I should say. Well, basically, the first message is you will continue to make a difference. This is an ongoing process. There will never be a mission accomplished. We will continue always to try to improve on our mission. So don't get discouraged. Don't get feeling a sense of smugness. Don't focus, as he mentioned, on presentism, as he called it, but always look to the future. More important, look behind you and beyond you. Look behind you to the person who has been left behind. Look beyond you, outside the borders of this beautiful USA. Always think, of course we know that you are mortal, but mortality does not stop us from trying to build a better world for the next generation. Few things you obviously know by now, but I should repeat. One, that there is not a single problem we are facing right now that we can resolve on our own, no matter how large or powerful. Whether we talk about HIV/AIDS, arms control, food crisis, climate change, wars, conflicts, there is not a single problem, I would argue, that we can resolve on our own. So our borders have some meaning, but not much. Our borders is really stretch as far as the human family to which we belong. And the earlier we come to the realization that we are one large human family and that we will succeed together, or we will fail together, the earlier we will be able to create a world where every human being has the right to live in peace, dignity, and freedom. Secondly, there is not a single problem we are going to be able to resolve without talking to each other, without dialogue. Whether I like or dislike the person or the nation, I need to understand where they are coming from. I need more to speak to my so-called enemies than to my friends. A policy of isolation and not talking to each other is a dead-end street. We know that at the personal level. We know that at the international level. Third, use of force absolutely doesn't resolve any single issue. In fact, it exacerbates wounds. Of course, we have to have the weapons to protect ourselves, but only as a last resort, and when we have exhausted every other possible means to resolve our differences through peaceful means. Fourth, double standards. I was last week in Davos in Sharm el Sheikh, and I told them, you know, that what I see from the developing part of the world, and I read a book recently when somebody was saying, we are poor but not stupid, and you cannot conceal double standards. And I think that's something we need to understand. Double standards with regard to wealth, power, security, you name it, it is not sustainable. Fifth, that development or prosperity and security come hand in hand. You know, I'm speaking the way I'm speaking today, which sounds a little bit odd because I'm supposed to focus on preventing nuclear weapon spread, arms control. But I've come to realize that I can't deal with the symptoms without addressing the causes. You know, if you want to have a world that it is at peace with itself, you have to start with poverty. Poverty, as I just mentioned again last week, is the most powerful weapon of mass destruction. Poverty usually is accompanied by lack of good governance, by repression. Repression ends in people feeling humiliated, angered, losing hope and faith. When you lose hope and you lose faith, this is a breeding ground for violence, civil war, interstate wars. And when you have conflict that has been raging on for 100 years, 50 years, 60 years, then the temptation to acquire the big stick, like the major powers, you know, which is nuclear weapons, is very tempting, you know, because we still live in an environment where the major powers rely on nuclear weapons as the ultimate club, you know, for power, for prestige, for deterrence and protection. So if I were to succeed, from turning, from being a fire brigade, put a fire off in Iraq, to have another one in Libya, to have another one in Iran, we really have to look at the structure and not just deal with the symptoms, but with the causes. We have to change, in other words, our mindset. And go back, as I said, to our original core values, where we are supposed to live by. And not simply use it in terms of rhetorics, but practice that. I'll give you some numbers, which again, numbers are usually very good. They're more convincing than a speech. We still have 40% of the world population live under $2 a day. That is 2 out of every 5 people live under $2 a day. We still have around 10 million children under the age of 5 dies every year. 25,000 child die daily because they are too poor to live. We still have 850 million people that go to bed hungry every night. Jim Morris, an American who used to run the World Food Program, is a good friend of mine, told me that if he will have 1% of what we spend on armament per year, we spent around $1 trillion on armament, if he will get 1% of that money, no person will go to bed hungry. Josette Chiran, who is now the successor of Jim Morris, again another American, I saw her last week. She is going around begging the world to raise $3 billion, again for the World Food Program, to feed children in Darfur, in Iraq, in Congo. And she was telling me if these kids do not get adequate nutrition, even for 1 month, up to the age of 2, they will be stunted for life. She is not able to get this $3 billion. And she was telling me that last Christmas bonus at Wall Street was $33 billion. Well, I mean, I put these numbers to you because it's not a question of ability to change. It's really a question of willingness to change. Disregard for sanctity of human life. I just came back from Austria when there is 2 Austrians have been taken hostages. And of course, every single newspaper, you know, writing about their story. In fact, my wife was just telling me today they were writing a long story about their dog, you know. But then I also had a dog, Cocker Spaniel, before, so I have nothing against dogs. But do we know, do we write, do we care about the 300,000 people who died at Darfur? Do we really know the name of any single person of the numbers between 500,000 to 1 million people who died in Iraq? The 3 million people who got maimed during the war? The 4 million people who got internally and externally displaced? For us, these are numbers. Well, and the question should be, are there lives that more important than others? And if there are, if that's the way we perceive or approach human life, do we really are surprised if the other side don't care about us? If we don't care about them, although they are part of us, why should they care for us? If we don't treat them as human beings, why should we expect them to act as human beings? I always say, and again, here is a chapel, you know, we are not born Mother Teresa or suicide bombers. You know, it's a question of the environment within which we are raised. Treat me as human being, I'll act as human being. There's a lot of other numbers about people in Darfur, in Rwanda, in Congo, but I will not bother you with this, but they are just horrible figures. Horrible figures. People who have died, innocent civilians who lost their lives, have nothing to do with the conflict. But I will just give you one last one. I mean, I was with Ban Ki-moon, the Secretary General of the UN, last week again, and the UN tried to get into Darfur when they have already 300,000 people died, 2 million people got displaced. The UN is trying desperately to get 24 helicopters and 17,000 troops for peacekeeping. They are not able to get that. 24 helicopters. So far, they only got an offer of 5 helicopters from Ethiopia and Bangladesh. It's 400 helicopters ready to go in NATO, but they did not offer. So we have problem again of security, and I mentioned that. You know, I run a system, the non-proliferation, where countries have been told we have reached a grand bargain in 1970. Those who have nuclear weapon committed themselves to move away from nuclear weapons. Those who do not have nuclear weapon committed themselves not to have nuclear weapons. But almost four decades after the non-proliferation treaty has been concluded, we still have 25,000 warheads in existence. Many of them on a minute launching alert status, as Samnan will tell you. We still maintain a lot of these weapons on the so-called Cold War hair trigger alert, by which decisions has to be made or have to be made in a matter of minutes. And it could be gross miscalculation, computer error, unauthorized launching. And yet, the entire civilization can go to ashes because of that. If that's the kind of security system we would like to live under, how could I go and continue to preach to the others that nuclear weapons are not good for you, while all the weapon states, without exception, are modernizing their nuclear weapons, are building new nuclear weapons, are even making plans to keep the nuclear weapon in infinity? A ray of good hope, at least, was this year when four people who are at the heart of national security, both Republican and Democrats, Henry Kissinger, Sam Nunn, George Shultz, and Bill Perry, came with a, in my view, groundbreaking article saying that we need to abolish nuclear weapons. That is, has become decreasingly effective, increasingly hazardous. If these people, you know, in their mature age, have come to that realization, we need to take that as a wake-up call. Because the most worry I have is not simply that more and more countries will develop nuclear weapons, but that nuclear weapons or radioactive sources will fall into the hands of extremism. And if that were to happen, the whole concept of nuclear deterrence, you know, mutual assured destruction, have no relevance. Because for extremist groups, you know, if they were to have nuclear weapons, they will use it. I mean, ideology for them, sacrificing their life, is not part of the equation. So we need, obviously, as urgently as we can, to develop a security system that does not depend on nuclear weapon. We invented nuclear weapon. We have to de-invent nuclear weapon. The argument that it is there, we cannot do with it, well, we need to continue to work to develop in our collective consciousness a way to approach nuclear weapons the way we approach slavery and genocide, a taboo, something that is unthinkable if we would like to continue to survive and maintain our civilization. Finally, the lack of effort to reach out. I mention again dialogue, you know. What I see now and what I worry about is circle the wagon mentality, a bunker mentality. You know, this part of the world, say the Muslim part of the world, is practicing a violent religion, is a bunch of terrorists, let us quarantine them. Well, that is absolutely, in my view, the wrong approach. You know, if you want to empower the moderates, you know, if you want to, you know, overcome those who are using religion, you know, or color or ethnicity for whatever sinister move, you need to reach out to the overwhelming majority of the moderates. And the last thing you need there is weapons. I saw recently that there will be another package of $50 billion of weapons going to the Middle East. And I said, the last thing you need in the Middle East right now is weapons. What you need is an institution building, you know, education, science and technology. This is what this region or any other part of the developing countries need. It's not weapons. It's reaching out. It's a dialogue. It's a respect. And yet we have seen recently the situation in Gaza, you know, when, you know, Gaza was, you know, subject to a collective punishment, 1.5 million people who could not get enough food, you know, or water. And again, if that was a solution, Karen Abizaid, who is the head of United Nations Agency for Relief of the Palestinians, told me the result of that was, in fact, that the most radicals of Hamas are now in the driver's seat. You know, you isolate people, you put the hardliners in the driver's seat. You integrate people, you empower the moderates. These are simple lessons which I hope, you know, we will try to learn from our own mistakes in the future and move forward. The world has become, this is a cliche, a globalized world, as I mentioned, you know, but we need to adjust our code of conduct, our ethics, our behavior to that reality. We need to understand that the world is not in good shape. We need to understand that we cannot just feel comfortable in our own little environment. We need to look, as I said, beyond that and behind us to see who is left behind. I will conclude by quoting Bill Clinton, you know, who said that we should be trying to build a world in this unique moment in history that we would like to live in when we are not the only big dog on the block. Thank you very much.
Let's take some questions.
Yeah, sure.
We are open for questions.
I'll be happy to answer any questions you have. Yes, please.
If you were able to give advice to the next president, whoever that be, what advice would you give in relation to our policy in Iraq?
In Iraq, I think in Iraq there's no military solution the way I see it. It has to be a political solution. You have to engage the neighbors. I was telling, the Arab government last week that you cannot just continue to sit on the fence. This is a regional conflict, has to be resolved within a regional context. So my advice would be reach out, try to find a political solution, engage all the neighbors. That's the only way to move forward. Please. Well, I think, again, it is uncertain, I would say. I mentioned that last week, that what I worry about there is the increasing gap between the rich and the poor. Democracy has not yet taken hold there. And again, democracy has to come from within. Democracy takes time. We all know that, but we have to take a certain concrete steps in that direction. People have to feel that they are being treated fairly. They have a say on who is governing them and how they are governed. Again, when I mentioned people saying we are poor but not stupid, I mentioned, in fact, people know the difference between genuine democracy and fake democracy. And that is, I still think it's a lot. Egypt has a lot to do, and the two most important things to me is democracy, education, fair distribution of wealth. We have in Egypt right now, I think, 7 or 8 people who are on Forbes' list of the most rich 500 people in the world. That's in a country where still the per capita income is $1,000. So there's something which is not sustainable to me.
This is the trouble. You say there's so many starving children, yet when we give aid to that country, it never gets down to these starving children. How can you change this?
Well, there's a lot of... there's two problems there. One is, are we giving enough? And we are not. The overall official development assistance, that you call it, is 10% of what we spend on armament. It's around $100 million a year, where we spent, as I said, $1 trillion on armament. Secondly, there are ways, of course, that you try to reach out to the end user, as they say, and there is UNICEF, WHO, World Food Program. But there are problems, of course. There are problems in countries, authoritarian regimes, who try to, confiscate the aid that's coming. But you have to use, as we all do, the carrot and the stick, incentives and pressure to make sure that assistance reach these people, these innocent children who are dying because out of malnutrition. But these are the issues where we should be really focusing on, as I said. We should not just be reading about it in the newspaper, but we should really be focusing on how to make sure that every single human being is treated with the same respect that we treat our own immediate family. Because if we do that, if we feel, I usually, if you come to my office in Vienna, and you will see a little, citation from the Bible, and when God asked Cain, when the first blood was shed, where is your brother? And Abel answered, I know not. am I my brother keeper? And my answer to anybody who comes to my office, until we answer that question in the affirmative, that I am, in fact, my brother keeper, we will not have an enduring peace. Yes, please. I can't hear you very well.
You spoke about the helicopters?
Yes. Well, unfortunately, it means that government react out of a sense of short-sightedness, cynicism, that Darfur does not figure as part of the geopolitical interest of major power. So you will see helicopters going to Afghanistan, for example, because Afghanistan is harboring Al-Qaeda and has a linkage to national security interests. But when you have a country like Darfur, it's a purely humanitarian case, you know. There is the call for assistance fall on deaf ear. Well, we, the supposed international community, adopted something called responsibility to protect in case of humanitarian, you know, genocide. Yet this is continued to remain within the realm of rhetoric and not really practice, as we have seen now in Darfur. Yes, please. I would not have gone into diplomatic service. But I should say, you know, I frankly was a diplomat for a while, but I felt very uncomfortable, in fact, serving one country. And I started to feel comfortable being an international civil servant, you know, when I feel that I don't, you know, I'm not accountable to anybody, yet I'm accountable to everybody, that I'm working without looking to the national interest of any particular country, but for the global common goods. That's where I'm comfortable, that's where I am today. But if you ask me, I will not have gone into a national diplomatic service. Please. Sorry, I can't hear you. Well, there's a lot the U.S. can do, and I hope will do. One is, for example, to ratify the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty. This was, for years, considered the jewel in the crown in the whole arms control system. Yet, it's still lingering in the Senate. You know, why do we still have the option to test new weapons? If we committed ourselves in 1970 to move away from nuclear weapons, and if the International Court of Justice said that this obligation means precise result, nuclear disarmament, well, we need a treaty to prohibit production of nuclear material for weapon purposes, the so-called cut-off treaty. For the last 10 years, negotiation has been completely stalemated. Yeah, and most importantly, we need to see drastic cut in the nuclear weapon arsenals. You know, if you do that, you have the moral authority to go after those who would like to develop nuclear weapons. If we continue to say, do as I say and not as I do, you know, your call will ring hollow, and it is not a sustainable system. Please, please. I can tell you I'm working on that report during this weekend here. And I'm serious. I'm not joking. Because I have to issue a report on Monday. Well, I think we haven't seen any concrete evidence today that Iran is developing a nuclear weapon, you know. There was some intelligent assessment by the CIA and other intelligence agencies saying that they have worked on certain weaponization studies in the past, but that these studies have been stopped in 2003. We haven't seen, that is the issue, remaining issue for us, which we are trying to clarify. Have they really worked in the past or possibly continue on some studies on weaponization? But we haven't seen, you know, an actual concrete evidence of working on nuclear weapons. We haven't seen nuclear material that is the key to develop nuclear weapon being diverted or underground produced. So that's why I continue to say, yes, we still have some worries about Iran, but I don't see Iran to be a clear and present danger today. And we still have enough time to deal with it diplomatically. We should not talk about use of weapon or arms or use of armed force, but we should talk primarily about dialogue, about reaching out. I don't think the Iranian issue will be resolved before there is a comprehensive dialogue between Iran and the U.S. The issue of Iran, so-called nuclear weapon or whatever we are looking at, is really a question of regional security. The most concern about Iran right now is not about Iran today, as you see and you read in the paper. It's about Iran tomorrow. Should Iran have the technology, the enrichment technology, that could be used in the future to develop nuclear weapons? That, as I kept saying, that is really a question of distrust, a question of confidence building about future intention. That's not an issue I can verify. I kept saying I can't verify what Iran is doing today. I cannot verify about any countries doing, I cannot read the tea leaves about who is going to do what in the future. This is a confidence building issue. The only way to build confidence is through sitting around a table, as you are doing in North Korea, trying to see how you find a solution where you can build confidence. As long as there is no actual negotiation, I think we'll continue to have this tension, this, you know, crisis, which we hopefully try to keep at a manageable level until we reach a position where we have a comprehensive dialogue that by nature has to do with the regional security in the Middle East. So the Iranian issue, nuclear issue, is the tip of the iceberg. It's not, it's one aspect of a very complex process of peace and stability in the Middle East. I am as comfortable as I'm comfortable when I fly from Vienna to here. You know, you take certain risk. Obviously, there is risk. I mean, there is however, you know, the technology, you know, has improved a lot in terms of safety. You know, but we have to continue to be very vigilant. We have to continue to be very alert to any weakness in the safety and security. But like with any other technology, it has its cost and benefit. People make different decisions. You know, in France, they rely on nuclear power for electricity for 78% of their electricity. In Ireland, they said no way, or in Austria, where our agency is, they are completely anti-nuclear. Say we do not want nuclear. However, I think we are seeing, the reality is we are seeing more and more countries now expanding their nuclear power programs or embarking on new introduction of nuclear energy as part of the energy mix, simply because of concern of climate change, fluctuation of oil and gas prices, quest for energy independence. So it is not a perfect solution, but again, it's a question of how do you make cost and benefit. You know, if you need energy, and you do need energy, energy is energy for development. Without energy, there is no development. You will have to take some risk, but you have to make sure that you maximize the benefit, minimize the risk, and that's what we try to do all the time. So I don't advise any country to use or not use nuclear power. I say I'm an agnostic on this issue, but if you make a decision to use it, I'll have to come with full force to make sure that you are using it safely, securely, and only for peaceful purposes. They are, well, there are few left in Ukraine and Russia, you know, and they have been, of course, in terms of safety, upgraded in a very substantial way. But I'll be more comfortable, you know, when these old reactors will reach their life cycle, the end of their life cycle. But right now, I think there has been hundreds of millions of dollars poured into this reactor to upgrade them to present-day safety standard. Sorry? Yeah. Well, North Korea has nuclear weapons, so I'm worried about North Korea as I'm worried about any country that has nuclear weapons. It's all, but more, it's of course a regime that is very much isolated. I was there in Pyongyang recently and I was told that 60% of the children in North Korea are stunted because of malnutrition. 60%, you know. That is a situation, obviously, that we need to change. And North Korea has nothing to offer. The only trump card they have is their nuclear weapon. And they're trying to maximize whatever price they'll get out of that. But if I have to pay if it was up to me, I'll have to pay as much as they do in terms of, you know, economic aid, humanitarian assistance, to get rid of their nuclear weapon arsenal. And also from a humanitarian perspective, just make sure that, you know, people there are able to have, you know, a decent standard of life, are able to eat, you know. So North Korea, you know, it's unlike Iran, does not have really an ideology to project in its region. I mean, they are all, you know, self-engrossed in themselves. It's a regime survival, if you like, you know. And that's much easier to address, in my view, than the Iranian issue, because, as I said, the Iranian issue is a very much part of this complex issue of the whole situation in the Middle East. But North Korea, I think some progress is made. Now, you know, Chris Hill, I think, is trying his best to, you know, to move on this issue. And it exactly proved my point. When North Korea was shunned, was isolated, they developed nuclear weapons. When you started talking to them, progress started to be made. That's the name of the game. Talk to whoever you think is your enemy. Yeah, please. Well, you can make all of the above. You know, you can help some of the poor people. There's a lot of charities, you know, that will welcome any contribution they get. I give a lot of speeches like these, but of course, unlike here, I get honorariums. So, But I send all these honorariums to four shelters, you know, four orphanage in Egypt. You know, well, that's not going to resolve all the problems in my own country, but at least I feel I'm making some contribution. You know, I speak up on some of these issues. I mean, you probably see all the time I'm being one of the most vilified people on the face of the earth, you know, being told that you are talking outside of the box, you are, you know, also, but, well, at least you can speak up. You can get engaged on security issues, this campaign now for abolishing nuclear weapons, you know. So whatever you do, you know, whatever you can help a human being in need, I think you are contributing, you know, and contribution takes so many different ways and shape, but you don't say this is the only way. and don't think that you alone will do it. But if all of us will contribute in whatever we do, well, we will have, I think, slightly better, a saner, safer, and more humane world.
You want to stop, or you want to stop?
I can. Thank you very much. Thanks so much. Thanks. I'm delighted and honored to be here.
Let me just conclude by saying I told the Director General that the college actually owns a strategic air command bunker. And that if he had called at the last minute to say plans had changed and he couldn't be with us, that's exactly where I was going to be heading. It is much more reassuring to know that Muhammad El-Baradei will be sleeping peacefully at the Lord Jeff tonight and working on his report for the world community. On occasion, this room has seen and touched history. We have again today, and as we will tomorrow, we wish you Godspeed.